And welcome to the Rick House. My name is Cyrus Farmer, and you are watching and listening to the Stomp the Tea podcast. Folks, we have so much to get into tonight. Let me tell you exactly what you can expect to hear. We're going to be talking about a documentary series that I watched the first part of this past Sunday called, it's called Live Aid. When rock and roll, when rock and roll took on the world, it is interesting. So we'll talk about that. And we'll also be talking about, we're going to be debuting a new segment from now until the end of the summer. And that segment, it kind of explores the history of some great, iconic sports-themed music. Folks, I think you're going to like the first part of this. We're going to do this between now and Labor Day. We're going to finish out the summer with a bang. And the first segment of this deals with a musical piece called Heavy Action. And we'll tell you all about what that is and why you've heard it. And of course, we'll also be going over everyone's favorite segment. What are you drinking tonight? But first, folks, I don't know if you watch the news or not. I mean, generally, when I wake up in the morning, I watch the local news largely so that I can get the weather, see what's going on around town, so on and so forth. But for whatever reason, a couple of days ago, I was up earlier than normal. And I turned on SportsCenter, and they showed me the highlights of the Summer League game between the Indiana Pacers and the Chicago Bulls. Folks, I think you know where I'm going here. Johnny Furphy, I believe is his name, had a dunk that literally has gone viral. You know, I have to tell you, Johnny Furphy, whom I've never heard of before. Furphy is spelled F-U-R-P-H-Y. Apparently, he's a second-year player for the Indiana Pacers. And he is from Australia. He's 20 years old. I'm sure he has a tremendous amount of talent. Who knows? But he actually performed a dunk over a member of the Chicago Bulls team, a young man named, I believe it's Noah Essengwai. Now, Noah, interestingly enough, is a first-year player, from what I understand. But he is from France. And Noah is 18 years old. So, again, a 20-year-old versus an 18-year-old on a fast break. It's just amazing. The NBA gets younger and younger and younger and younger. It is unbelievable. Folks, I'm going to show you this clip. I'm going to pull it up on my phone. Now, those of you who are watching on YouTube, you're going to be able to see the actual clip. For those of you who are listening on Spotify, Apple Music, just look it up. You'll hear the audio, but look it up. It's worth watching. There is a thousand different versions of this dunk on social media right now. And I'm going to show you the version I like. And the reason I like it is because of how it was reported on SportsCenter. So, without further ado, here is the clip of the now famous Johnny Furphy dunk.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that is the clip. And I can tell you right now, there is a huge problem for Noah Esenguy. Folks, I have three words for Noah Esenguy. Take the foul. You cannot get dunked on like that for any reason. Look, I've been trying to figure out what's actually worse. The photo that they show you of the dunk, which is essentially the poster, or the reaction by the commentators on SportsCenter. And I will say this, let's be fair. There is nothing worse than that photo, but it is only, in my opinion, marginally worse than the actual reaction by the commentators on ESPN. You can't have people falling out laughing at a picture of you getting dunked on by somebody else. Noah, I'm not talking about hurting anybody, all right? Wrap him up. You cannot afford to be in this poster. Now, look, again, I've never heard of Johnny Furphy before, but if this is how he plays on a regular basis, now, mind you, Johnny Furphy averaged, I think, 2.1 points a game, and he also averaged 7.6 minutes a game during 2025, his rookie season. But if this is how he plays, once he gets comfortable, the Pacers might be okay until Tyrese Halliburton gets back. I'm telling you right now. Noah, a picture lasts forever. This image, and folks, look it up. Those of you on Apple Music, those of you who are on Spotify, who did not see the clip that I showed you, there's an image of the poster. That image is going to be on t-shirts. That image is going to be on fat heads. That image is going to be on towels, coffee mugs. This image may last longer than either Johnny Furphy's or Noah Esenguy's career. That's how iconic the image is. You can't have it. You just can't have it. Noah, in the future. Noah might end up being a Hall of Fame player. He might end up having multiple championship wins. He might end up being a league MVP. Who knows? He's 18 years old. But he will never, ever, ever, ever escape this poster that Johnny Furphy put on him. So, for all of you out there in the future, again, we're not talking about hurting anybody, but you cannot be on that poster. Wrap them up. Commit the foul. Trust me, you'll thank me later. All right, I wanted to get that out of the way. And I also want to talk a little bit about the Open Championship. Folks, it begins hours from now. And I think you have to be pretty insane to bet on anyone to win the Open Championship outside of Scottie Scheffler or Rory McIlroy. Well, I can tell you right now, my official pick for this year's Open Championship winner will be Rory McIlroy. I think he's going to bookend the year by winning the first and the fourth majors of the season. Rory had a very good showing, as usual, in the Scottish Open last week. You know, he's in the last group, loses by two. If he makes anything on the back nine, he dominated the back nine the first 3 days of the tournament. I think he went something like 7 under over the first 3 days on the back nine. And of course, back nine on Sunday, Rory shoots even par. Fine. If he makes anything at all, he probably wins the tournament. That's okay. This is a tournament that Rory doesn't want or need to win necessarily. He wants to win the Open Championship this week at Royal Portrush next to his hometown. So I think that it's going to be an interesting Open. I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of shape the course is in. Rory is getting his driver in play, which I think is kind of the beginning, middle, and end for him as far as scoring is concerned. Once he's in play with his driver, everything else, I think, kind of falls into place, with the possible exception of his consistent putting, which he's never been a great putter. But, you know, he does what he can. Now, I'm going to tell you right now, folks, and I'm going to be unabashed about this. The golfer I will be rooting for, I think Rory's going to win. And I could be wrong. Who knows? But the golfer I will be rooting for to win will be one Justin Rose. I mean, I would love to see Justin get a second major. He's been so close on a number of occasions. Obviously, losing two playoffs in the Masters does not help. And let's not forget, this is a golfer. Justin Rose is a Hall of Famer in my career. I think Justin Rose has a gold medal. I think he won the first Olympic gold medal in golf when it was reintroduced. I think that was the London Games. Justin Rose deserves to win an Open Championship. I mean, he had an unbelievable, I think it was Royal Birkdale. Justin's like 17 years old, and he finishes top five for the tournament. He contended all week. I would love to see him actually cross this off his list of goals and accomplishments. I'm rooting hard for you, Justin. Who knows what will happen, but I would love to see you win. Additionally, I would really like to see Xander Schauffele defend his title and salvage what has been a very disappointing year by anybody's standards, especially, I think, Xander's standards. If Xander could find a way to pull it all together and go back-to-back in the Open Championship, this year will have been a real win for Xander Schauffele. I don't expect that to happen, but I'm rooting for Xander. And I would not mind seeing him win at all, because Xander has done very little all year. And I'd like to see him back in the winner's circle. I'd like to see him compete consistently. I know he had the injury, but if you're Xander Schauffele, it comes down to two things. Are you going to be Mark O'Meara, who was a very good golfer and won the Masters and the British Open in 1998 and never won as a PGA player another major? Or are you going to be Ernie Els, who won tournaments, was a wonderful player, and also won, I think, four or five majors? He won two U.S. Opens, I believe, he didn't win the Masters, but I think he won two U.S. Opens, an Open Championship, a British Open, and probably one more in there somewhere. So who are you going to be, Xander? Are you going to be Mark O'Meara, or are you going to be Ernie Els? I'm really rooting for you to be Ernie Els. So let's see what happens. I can tell you right now that I really think that I don't know what to think of Scottie Scheffler right now. All I know is that whenever he tees it up, he usually contends, and it happens usually fairly quickly by Saturday. So let's see what happens by the time they get to the third round. I don't know if there's any weather. I literally have not paid any attention to the run-up to the Open Championship. Bad job by me. But I don't know if there's any weather in the forecast, but I want to see what Royal Port Rush looks like again. I want to see if Shane Lowry finds a little bit of magic and finds a way to contend. I want to see a whole bunch of things. But mostly, I want to see who's going to win this championship. Maybe it's J.J. Spahn. Could J.J. Spahn go back-to-back? Who knows? All right, folks, on to the show. CNN has produced a documentary series. It is called Live Aid, When Rock and Roll Took on the World. Now, this series, I believe it's a three-part series. It talks about the inception and all the challenges and everything that went into creating the iconic Live Aid concerts, which took place in Philadelphia and in London back in 1985, I believe. And they were broadcast globally. You saw all the London performances. You saw all the Philadelphia performances. It was a very of-the-moment event. And most people who were young watched as much of it as they could. It was like the Olympics for young people. So I watched it. It was great. It all started. This is episode one that I saw this past Sunday. And let me tell you what was involved in the episode. It all started when Bob Geldof saw a piece on the from the BBC on the famine in Ethiopia. Now, Bob Geldof, who is Bob Geldof? I had never heard of Bob Geldof before Live Aid, before Band Aid, before any of this. Apparently, he was the lead singer of a group called the Boomtown Rats. They've been around for about a decade by 1984, and apparently were relatively successful in the UK, and obviously had some kind of following globally, large, small, whatever. But they were known. I didn't know them, but that doesn't mean much. So Geldof sees this report on the famine in Ethiopia, and he's like, you know, someone has to do something. This is horrible. And this is like in the height of 80s consumption, the me decade, right? The 1980s in the West being the US, UK, I assume Italy and France, maybe Spain, was a very consumption-oriented decade. You know, make money, spend money, eat like a glutton, take drugs like Tony Montana, literally go crazy. It was a me decade. And 1984 was kind of like the peak of all of that, 84, 85. So Geldof is trying to find a way. He sees this documentary in the fall, this piece on the BBC, and he's like, we all have to do something. And it's interesting. CNN is really very granular in their approach to this docuseries. I mean, they really get down to the nitty-gritty. They talk about how the famine was occurring in Ethiopia, but the U.S. was kind of, they weren't against Ethiopia, they weren't for Ethiopia, they were kind of ambivalent about helping end the famine in Ethiopia simply because it's the Cold War. And Ethiopia was firmly aligned with the Soviet Union. They were literally backed by the Soviet Union, the Ethiopian government, from what I understand. And the Ethiopian government embraced their relationship with the Soviet Union. So the United States, being in the middle of the Cold War, essentially said, well, if you guys are starving, let the Soviet Union help you, essentially. But there was a piece on NBC News, apparently, that aired in the fall of 1984, late October. And following that NBC News report, the Reagan administration released 300,000 metric tons of wheat to the people of Ethiopia from the government reserves here in the U.S. And they also released $50 million This was to help famine relief, because apparently the piece, you know, anchored by Tom Brokaw of NBC News, was very moving at the time. Now, Band-Aid, which is the collection of British artists that Bob Geldof pulled together to record a single, the single was called Do They Know It's Christmas, was recorded in one day, and that was recorded on November 25th of 1984. Folks, some of the people involved in this recording are obviously household names. Sting, Bono, Phil Collins, Paul Young, George Michael, Boy George, just to name a few. I mean, you also had Bananarama, Spandau Ballet, Duran Duran, Kool and the Gang, somehow, from America, slipped in to the Do They Know It's Christmas song, benefit single, and video from Band-Aid over in London. Who knew? I was a big Kool and the Gang fan, by the way. I still am. Now, the morning they gathered to record this song, Boy George was actually slated to join them, but he was in New York. He was groggy. Geldof, I think, basically woke him up with a phone call basically saying, where are you? And Boy George is groggy. He's like, And Geldof says, hey, get on a Concorde and get over here so we can record you. We want you to be a part of this. Now, Boy George, just to be fair, was the lead singer of a group called Culture Club. And they were very 80s, very of the era, much like Duran Duran and some of the other British pop bands. And the fascinating thing to me about this documentary is that they actually talk about putting Boy George on a Concorde to get over to London so that they can record with him. Folks, I don't know how many of you are aware, but the Concorde was one of the first, I think it's the first and only transatlantic flight that was supersonic. The Concorde was a staple in the 80s, 90s, I think up to early 2000, where you could fly from New York to London in about 3 hours, give or take. Now, that flight normally would have taken like seven and a half hours on a regular plane, but the Concorde flew, the cruising speed was twice the speed of sound. And that was the big, really kind of the hook. The Concorde could get you up and down in less time than it took you to drive from, let's say, New York to DC. You could be in New York and get to London or vice versa in 3 hours and change, go through customs and or not, and you're done. It's amazing what a revelation the Concorde was. And it's one of the examples, one of the few examples of an advancement in society that makes life so much simpler, but goes away for other reasons, whether those reasons were environmental, whether those reasons were the cost of jet fuel or cost of keeping up the fleet, who knows? But you very rarely see an advancement like traveling transatlantic in half the time that it would take you to do so commercially go away. Now, the tickets were very expensive. The tickets, a round trip from New York to London, cost about $20,000 in today's money. It's a lot of money. I always wanted to take the Concorde. I'd heard about the Concorde my whole life. I always thought maybe one day I'll book a gig in London and they'll fly me over on the Concorde. Alas, it was not to be. Never happened. But I always wanted to take the Concorde. And I was a little annoyed when I found out they were suspending, a.k.a. ending, the Concorde program when that happened a couple decades ago. But we move on. Anyway, back to the documentary. Now, they fly Boy George over. And everyone's doing their thing. You know, this docuseries, CNN does a great job of kind of setting the table about the history and the context about what was happening back then, so on and so forth. But I will be fair. It really starts to take off once they get to the recording of Do They Know It's Christmas? You see these great clips of everyone, and they're so young. Bono, Sting. I mean, they look like babies. George Michael. It's very interesting. And, you know, there's this great story about Phil Collins kind of hanging out. Phil Collins brings his drum kit. You know, Phil Collins was a drummer, for those of you who don't know. Lead singer of a group called Genesis. He brings his drum kit, and they say in the documentary, he's hanging out around 7 hours, just waiting to do any kind of recording. And once he sets up his kit and they say, Phil, you're on, he starts playing the drums. And all these stars, these British pop stars, they all start to come and gather and watch him play and record. And he says that's when he really started to feel the pressure. But, you know, talent usually rises. It doesn't fall. So if you have the talent, you just keep doing what you do, and people watch you do it. So that was awesome. They talk about Boy George swooping in to sing a couple of lines and then the chorus, essentially. And then he's like, what else is there? And he's like, no, we only need you for this little bit, Boy George. Who, to be fair, is probably the biggest star in that room. Let's remember, it's 1984, right? Sting and the Police had recorded Synchronicity by then and released that. Duran Duran was a huge, huge group. Bono and U2 were kind of still like an underground or garage kind of band, relatively speaking. Paul Young was well-established pop star, but none of them were Boy George and Culture Club. Culture Club was, as far as British pop is concerned, about as big as you can get in 1984. So it's funny because Boy George is probably the biggest star in that room, and yet you have George Michael there and Sting and Bono. Fascinating. Now, apparently the Ethiopian officials, once the song is released, it raises a lot of money. Do They Know It's Christmas? And it's a big hit globally as well as in the UK. But people in Ethiopia weren't in love. While they appreciated the sentiment, they weren't in love with the title of the song. You have to understand, folks, according to this documentary, Ethiopia was, I think, the only African country that was never colonized. They're fiercely independent, very proud people, and also one of the oldest Christian countries in the world. So they hear this song, Do They Know It's Christmas? It's like, what are you talking about? It's like, we invented Christmas. I mean, it's like they are so apparently Christian that I think they took the song a little literally, and their reaction was a little muted about the title of the song and some of the lyrics. You know, one Ethiopian official says they being Geldof and his compatriots, they didn't do their homework, right? But, you know, you're trying to put together a song that's going to help people, and you don't always get everything right. You just try to get it out. Now, it's interesting because at the end of episode one, you know, they talk about Geldof traveling to Ethiopia about a month or so after the record is released. It's a big hit globally. He walks down among the people and the children. He was obviously concerned, you know, I don't want to be holding any dead babies, so on and so forth. But he gets thrust, Bob Geldof, into this kind of position of being representative of caring, essentially, about famine in Africa and the people. And he meets Mother Teresa. He meets Margaret Thatcher. He has interchanges with both and many more. And you get the sense that after that album, that record is released, that single is released, and Geldof goes to Ethiopia to kind of go on the ground to see what's happening. And then he gets back. You get the sense that it all becomes a lot more real for Bob Geldof. He's like, you know, I was just trying to help. I recorded a song, tried to raise some money. I'm still on the clock here. But to his credit, he shows up, and I remember in real time, he always seemed like a firm leader of this initiative, and that he had very few doubts. I didn't know anything. I was a kid. But he had very few doubts or misgivings, and he seemed like a real why can't we do it kind of leader, which I will always give him credit for now and in the future. He did a great, great, great job, and he left a mark on the world. So that was episode one. Let's see what happens in episode two and three. I'm sure episode two deals with We Are the World, I'm sure. And then episode three will probably deal with the concerts in London and Philadelphia. But if you have a chance, I think you should watch it. It's worth watching. It's interesting. Now, let's talk about this new segment we're debuting. I don't have a title for this. I don't have a name for this. I should, but I can't think of one. But I want to talk about iconic sports theme music. And we've all heard any number of them. Why do I like iconic sports theme music? Because it gets me ready for the game. It's familiar. And I know when I hear this music, I'm about to watch something that is literally going to be of tremendous interest to me. So the first segment of this new segment deals with a song. It's probably one of the most famous pieces of sports theme music in history. And it deals with a song called Heavy Action. What is Heavy Action? Well, I can tell you. Heavy Action was composed in 1970 by a musician named Johnny Pearson. I want to get that right. Heavy Action eventually became the theme song to Monday Night Football. All right. So I'm going to play this for you. And for those of you who are on Spotify and on Apple Music, you're not missing anything. I'm just playing the music. There's no video here. But I'm going to play it to familiarize you with the piece of music we're talking about. Here it is, Heavy Action. Okay, so we all know that piece of music. To me, it is one of the greatest sports theme music in the history of music. I don't know what they were playing in the Olympic Games in Greece. I don't know what they were playing in the Roman Colosseum. I don't know what they were playing during the first US Open, first British Open. But that piece of music is so iconic to me. It means football. And more importantly, it means Monday Night Football. Johnny Pearson was commissioned by the BBC to write that piece of music for its music library. Now, Johnny Pearson at the time was a member of the orchestra for a show called Top of the Pops. There was a big weekly show in Britain in the 60s and 70s, I believe. And the orchestra at Top of the Pops would accompany whatever pop star was on the show that week while they sang their song. So they were very versatile, very talented. It's like the Tonight Show band, right? Heavy Action first made its debut on a show called Superstars. Now, Superstars apparently was a show in Britain in 1973 that ran for years. But it originally aired here in America as a two-hour special before it became a series in Britain. Now, throughout the late 70s, Superstars was a big ABC sports show. You would have like these 10 events. It was basically like a decathlon for different sports stars. You would have the 100-yard dash, a swimming event, an obstacle course, all these different events. And different sports stars from different fields would all compete. And then eventually, here in America, they turned it into celebrities competing. They called it Battle of the Network Stars. And ABC would compete against NBC and CBS. So it was interesting. Now, ABC acquired the rights to this song, Heavy Action, during the 1975 football season. And this is really where it was introduced to America, because there was a man named Howard Cosell. Now, Howard Cosell, who is Howard Cosell? He's a legendary, legendary sports announcer, broadcaster, reporter, covered Muhammad Ali. Throughout his entire career, was part of Olympic coverage, was a legendary, was part of the original Monday Night Football cast and crew. Think of Howard Cosell. He was kind of like the Brooklyn Jewish version of Stephen A. Smith. He was very, very, very well loved and equally, if not more, despised by the viewing public. People just didn't like him. But he had as many fans as he had detractors, and that's part of what made Howard Cosell must-watch TV. You can say the same thing for Stephen A. Smith to a degree. So, this music was played during the halftime segment that Howard Cosell would show highlights of the previous week's games on Monday Night Football. It was great. I used to watch this. It was awesome. And remember, there's no sports center. There's no cable. None of that. So if you want to watch what happened in a game that you didn't actually live in the market to see, you had to watch something like Monday Night Football at halftime to see what the highlights were. And this music played underneath. It actually became an official theme song. They used it at ABC for Monday Night Football starting in 1976. But it became the official theme song for Monday Night Football in 1989. This piece of music has been used forever. And it is very well deserving of an intro segment to this end of summer kind of examination of sports theme music. Now, I can tell you this. Do you know what the original, from 1970 to 1975, do you know what the original music sounded like to introduce Monday Night Football? It was a piece of music called Score, all right? And this is what Score sounded like. I can't believe this opened Monday Night Football when it first started. Listen to this. Yeah. So obviously, that was of an era, and somehow it lasted 5 years. They played that on the show. Can't believe it. Anyway, that is the segment on sports theme music. We'll have another one for you next week. I hope you enjoyed that. I know I did. Learned a lot of interesting stuff. Now, we're at the point of the show now where I get to ask you a question. And that question is, what are you drinking tonight? Well, I can tell you what I'm drinking. And that is Virginia Distillery Company's single malt whiskey, single barrel. Folks, I'm going to tell you a little bit about this product. I'll tell you what's in this bottle, and I'll tell you what I think of it. It is bottled by the Virginia Distillery Company in Lovingston, Virginia. It is American single malt whiskey blended with Scottish single malt whiskey, and it's aged 4 years in ex-bourbon barrels, and then finished for a minimum of 1 year in port-style wine cask. Now, this is cask strength. The ABV is 59%, makes it 118 proof. This particular bottle is from barrel 2243, and it cost me $50. What do I think of it? Folks, apparently the Virginia Distillery Company is leaning very heavily into American single malt whiskey, which apparently just got licensed by the TTB as a true designation in January of 2025. So American distilleries can actually produce American single malt whiskey under certain protocols and make it official. I think it's pretty good. It's sweet. It's sweet but savory. Good kick, but nothing that's going to hurt you. It is definitely worth having in your bar. $50 a bottle? I mean, I might have one or two of these around between now and the end of the year. I'm all for anyone who's doing something different and leans in with their product. And I feel like the Virginia Distillery Company is doing just that with their American single malt whiskey. So I'm into it. You should try it, especially if you get it for $50 a bottle. It's completely worth it. Again, this is almost 120 proof. It's completely worth it. Add it to your bar. Let me know what you think. All right. So that is the show for tonight. I want to thank you all for watching. I want to thank you all for listening. My name is Cyrus Farmer. This is the Stomp the Tea podcast. Folks, we will be coming at you for obviously every week following, week in, week out. This is what we do here. We are here for you. So tell anyone with ears how much you enjoy the Stomp the Tea podcast. But for now, thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. My name is Cyrus Farmer. And as always, we will see you on the first tee.